Welcome to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. My name's Theo Finnegan, and I'm talking to Dr. Bryn Skibo from VAU's English Department. On Friday, January 19th, from 10 till 11:30 in the Malaspina Theatre, Bryn will give a presentation titled Mino Bamatsuan as Critical Theory, Reading Atwood's Speculative Fiction Through an Ojibwe Lens. Bryn Skibo did a PhD and postdoctoral research at the University of Geneva, specializing in narratology, animal studies, indigenous studies, and vegan studies. Hi, Bryn. How are you doing today?
I am doing chillily, but well.
It's a cold day. I went outside today, and it's not usually minus 18.
No, it's part of the reason why I moved here.
Yeah.
Minus 18.
Speaking of moving, could you just talk a little bit about your journey to academia, maybe in general, and then specifically to VIU or Nanaimo as well, more specifically?
So I did my bachelor's degree. So I'm initially from the US, that's where I got started. But even, you know, growing up in the US, I grew up all over the place. So I started on the West Coast, I wound up on the East Coast. I did my BA at American University, which is in Washington, DC, because I thought I wanted to be a diplomat. I thought, like, I wanted to travel the world and speak all these different languages. So I did my BA degrees in French and international relations. And I got my, I had a couple internships with the French embassy and some think tanks, and I worked at the US Capitol. And then eventually I realized that I wasn't super keen on US politics. I think anybody who has experienced US politics would probably say that. So I kind of on a whim did a summer program in global economics in Geneva, Switzerland, and that took me to Switzerland. I then very luckily got a job, kind of as a temporary job, at the World Trade Organization, and that temp job lasted 3.5 years. And I worked at the press office, and it was there that I realized that I had always really loved writing, copy editing, and publication production, and just general kind of press office work for the spokesman. And I realized that I really liked it. It's something that I've always really been attracted to. I was also freelancing at the time as a freelance editor, French to English, freelance copy editing, freelance copywriting. And I just thought, like, I need to advance my skills. I was now kind of in my mid-20s and realized, like, hey, there's a career here, but you have to advance your skills in some way. So I left the World Trade Organization and went and joined the English department at the University of Geneva, thinking that I would get my master's degree in English, try and get some more experience as a journalist, and then go back to the World Trade Organization. And kind of life threw a wrench in the works, where it turned out that I actually really loved English literature and can get a job in English literature. And so I got my master's degree, and my supervisor for that asked if I wanted to stay on and become a PhD assistant and start working on a PhD. And that gave me a 5-year contract. And that's kind of how I got started. And academia, it was very much kind of all by accident. I just followed the thing that I was really good at. And so I started working in as a PhD assistant in Geneva. And then my partner at the time just really needed a change of pace. And so I was now 4 years into my PhD project. It was kind of rolling along as smoothly as a PhD project can go. So rockily. So we moved to Vancouver, and I finished my PhD, went back to Switzerland for my postdoc, did a year's postdoc during COVID, which was as much fun as it sounds, postgraduate work in a rented living room, very far away from your family. And then I finished my postdoc. I applied to VIU thinking, like, you know, BC is home. That's where I want to be. And I was extraordinarily lucky in that in one of my first applications in academia as a postgrad, I got my job at VIU, and I moved here, and that's how I got here. And it was kind of all by accident. I never imagined 15 years ago that I'd be living on an island off the coast of British Columbia. Yeah. But here I am, and it's great.
That's quite a ways from Geneva. Yeah. What did you do your doctorate on? What was your specialization?
So I had initially thought I was going to specialize in what is called altered state narratives. So I started reading Hunter S. Thompson and Gonzo journalism. And I have, like I said, I started out thinking I wanted to be a journalist. And so I was really fascinated in this twist of journalism that took place in around the late 50s into the 70s, which eventually culminated in Hunter S. Thompson's Gonzo journalism.
What is Gonzo journalism, and why do you call it that?
That word has really plagued me, because I'd done a story in the Kentucky Derby for Scanlon's. A friend of mine, he wrote me a note saying that Derby piece with Pure Gonzo. And I got this onslaught of mail. Mail called saying I made a great breakthrough in journalism. I thought, well, Christ, if I made it, this breakthrough, we got to call it something. I mean, so I just liked the word Gonzo, and it seemed to mean what I was doing. Kind of, there's a mixture of humor and kind of a high stomping style in it, you know, it's a bit more active than your normal journalism.
And it still continues. People still write like that. It's called subjective journalism, where instead of hiding the author, we note the author and we express the author's interaction with the events of the day. And so I thought that's what I wanted to do. And that was actually my first publication, is in Altered State Narratives, which I wrote as a master's student. And I was working on the project as I was trying to finish off one of my master's essays, just, you know, finish off a class, a master's essay, whatever, trying to finish this godforsaken project on altered state narratives. It was just not going anywhere and was like holding a jellyfish in the rain. It was awful. And in the meantime, I wrote this paper, which was looking at the representation of animals in science fiction. And I said that these three science fiction texts were doing something really interesting, which is essentially that they were flipping the script on human exceptionalism. And all of these sci-fi texts were reframing humans as completely unexceptional, and everything that was closer to animal was exceptional, which is unusual, you would think, for sci-fi, which is all about the advancement of technology and human innovation. And so I was like, oh, this is interesting. Wrote the paper, presented it, went back to holding this, like, you know, jellyfish of a project. And my supervisor came along and was like, hey, why don't you just finish your master's thesis, just change it and write it on this other paper that you did on animals and science fiction instead, you know, and then you can focus on your graduate, your doctoral dissertation. And so I did. I finished my master's thesis, you know, relatively quickly, and then went back to trying to do something with my doctoral dissertation until finally I was like, Bren, stop trying to reinvent the wheel. You have a project. It's right here. And that's when my supervisor was like, I think you want to work in animal studies. I think that's where your brain is. And that's kind of when I realized, like, oh, I didn't even realize that animal studies was a thing. Like, I didn't know that we could write about animals. And that's what I did my doctoral dissertation on. And started out looking at animal studies, animals, representation of animals, and animalizing language in science fiction. A second chapter was going to talk about the representation of animals in Native American literature. And then, and this is what I'll talk about in my colloquium talk, is eventually I just conflated the two. And that's where I think my dissertation actually got quite cool, if I can say so myself.
You can plan as much as you like with research. And obviously you have to do some conscious thinking, right? But there's a role of serendipity, you know, luck or randomness, or sometimes even not failure, but that sort of, I mean, I always think with my PhD that, I mean, I wrote what I set out to write in some ways. I mean, it changed over time too, but the project didn't change all that much. But I always think that I kind of figured out what I wanted to write on by the time I finished the thing I wrote. And maybe that's a good thing, that you find stuff and discover things to do next. So that animal essay, that original essay, was part of a course, presumably, right? A master's course. But were animals part of your life beyond academia before, as a kid? And like, does the interest in animals have a sort of root?
Definitely. I have a dog sitting next to me right now. He comes to school all the time. You know, I learned from another theorist, Anna Haraway, that I work with, whom I work a lot in terms of her work or her research. She calls, you know, one of her dogs that she writes about a lot in a companion species manifesto, she calls her dog her research assistant. And initially when I read that, I was like, oh yeah, that's cute. But the more I think about it, and the more I, you know, do my work and encounter, you know, just continue on my life with my dog Bonnie, who is now 13 years old or 12 and a half years old, she is constantly impacting or just reminding me of, you know, we have this anthropocentric or human-centric way of viewing the world. Of course we do. We go around in the world in a human-shaped body. So of course that's how we perceive the world. But growing up as a kid, I always had two dogs. I had, I think at one point, my brothers and I, my parents, we had three rabbits, at one point, 15 birds. My brother had a horse for a bit. We just had animals all over the place. And we grew up with them, and they were just kind of a present and a constant in the house. And so now Bonnie is the constant in my house. And I am every day surprised at different things that she reminds me of, or that she informs me of. And I think that I, you know, have tried to decenter my anthropocentrism as much as I possibly can. And every day she's like, no, you didn't. How would I say this? She's fundamental to my work. There's something that I think about a lot. There's a researcher, Barbara Smuts, if anybody's interested, S-M-U-T-S, Barbara Smuts. She does really interesting work. And one of the things that I read a long time ago, right when I was starting to enter into the field of animal studies and, you know, realizing that this thing that I always just thought was, you know, a personal thing, like I love animals. I've lived with animals my whole life. It's not appropriate for academic research, like journalism. Is an appropriate academic topic. Altered state narratives, an appropriate academic topic. Oh, I just like animals, not appropriate. And it turns out, no, this is a rich field that is really, now it's more developed, but it really started to get into its heyday and its development around in the early 2000s, 2010s. Barbara Smuts wrote something about how when she is walking through a human world, so a city, for instance, she is the communicator for her and her dog. She is responsible for keeping her dog safe, and she needs to communicate with her dog that, like, hey, I'm in charge in this situation. Mm. But she also really enjoys moments when she is in the woods, and she's not the main communicator. Yeah. She's not really adept at reading this environment. It's a non-human environment, and so she kind of shifts over and pays more attention to what her dog is attempting to communicate to her, because the dog is probably going to be the one that's going to keep her more safe. And I spend a lot of time walking in the woods with Bonnie, and I think about that idea almost every week. Like, just, what is Bonnie trying to communicate to me right now that I am not picking up on? Or what is she seeing that I'm not paying attention to?
It's Chris Alemany from the Media Studies Department at Vancouver Island University, and you are listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM, Nanaimo.
So you're giving a colloquium presentation next Friday. Could you maybe, without giving too much away, tell us a little bit about what you're going to talk about?
I'm going to talk a lot at the beginning about cultural appropriation versus cultural appreciation. As a white American now living on the traditional territory of the Sinemuk people, it's something I think about a lot. As a settler scholar working in Native studies, it's something I think about a lot. And it's just an idea that I have wrestled with for a long time. And I think that a lot of non-Indigenous people are probably in a similar boat. So I thought this is both maybe a helpful introduction to the conversation and maybe also a useful introduction to the conversation. But the reason why I'm talking about cultural appropriation versus cultural appreciation is because the real key moment in my doctoral dissertation arose when I was completely stuck and I had writer's block for about 9 months in what I wanted to say about Margaret Atwood's science fiction trilogy, Margaret Atwood. And I just felt like everything that I was doing was just done before, and it was kind of obvious. Maybe it wasn't obvious to other people, but it seemed obvious to me. And I was using all the conventional, you know, post-structuralist and post-humanist and post-post-post European critical theories that we use for this kind of stuff. And I just hated my project again, and nothing was going anywhere. And so I was planning on teaching a course on Louise Erdrich, who is an Ojibwe writer from the United States. And I wanted to teach her work through an Ojibwe lens because I thought we'd get more out of the novels that way. So I just did my due diligence, and I you know, really did a deep dive into Ojibwe history, Ojibwe culture. This requires that you learn some of the Ojibwe language. I wanted the secular stories, the spiritual stories. I wanted everything. And in doing this research to supposedly write about an Ojibwe writer, and doing all this research, all of a sudden I knew what I wanted to say about Margaret Atwood's science fiction trilogy. And I realized that I had just applied Ojibwe concepts by philosophies as critical theory to a non-Ojibwe writer. And I was like, oh, this is super neat. I checked. Nobody had ever done this before. So that box was checked for a doctoral dissertation. But immediately I was like, I don't think you should be doing this. This is hugely inappropriate. And it took a lot of checking with Ojibwe people. I had insight from experts, Ojibwe elders, knowledge holders in the development of the project. And it took a lot of personal wrestling with, what are you comfortable with? Where is this material coming from? Is this material that is okay to share? If it's been published to the wider audience, it should be okay for you to use. But like every single time I am working with this material, I am asking myself, are you doing this in the right way? And so that's why I thought it might be useful to just start the conversation by just talking about cultural appreciation versus appropriation. And then I will give the audience an example of how I use this as critical theory to interpret Margaret Atwood's novel, and just a key scene that I thought was really important.
Which novel are you going to talk about?
That's the Mad Atom. It's
Mad Atom.
Final installation of what's called the Mad Atom trilogy, which starts with Oryx and Crake, which a lot of people are more familiar with. Then there's the second novel, Year of the Flood, and then the third and final novel, which is Mad Atom.
Speculative fiction, the kind of classic idea of it is it's sort of a predictor or something, right? That,
yeah.
that it sort of takes contemporary conditions and extrapolates a bit and sort of thinks, oh, where are we headed, right?
Right.
I guess I wondered if you agree with that on any level, and secondly, if is this kind of fiction, which I think has probably always been important since its inception, like really important now, considering it's not a far off future anymore, the kind of stuff that's coming down the pike. And so there's sort of an urgency, obviously, yes, generally to think about the climate and geopolitics and so on, but is speculative fiction more urgent now, would be my question.
I feel like speculative fiction has always been important because yep. every society at any time is going to be facing crises to some extent. Like in the 1950s, we thought we were going to blow up the world with nuclear bombs. So Margaret Atwood has somewhat of a reputation, a legend building up around her as this. I think one newspaper article that I read about her called her the prophetess of the future. And I was like, okay.
Nice.
She does seem to have a way, and I know how she does this. She doesn't have a crystal ball in her back room. She has said in numerous interviews that she is constantly reading popular science magazines like Scientific America. She really, really likes these types of publications. Mm-hmm. She's obviously an avid consumer of the news. And she has said over and over and over again that it's really important to her in her sci-fi work. And she vehemently disagreed at one point that she was writing science fiction. She said she was writing speculative fiction, but that's another debate for another time.
Mm-hmm.
She said that in her science fiction or speculative fiction, that it's very important for her that she's not inventing anything that hasn't already been done or for which we don't already have the technology.
Mm.
So that's why when people who read her work, who aren't necessarily reading the news as closely or Scientific American as often as she does, are like, oh my God, how did she see this coming? And it's like,
mm-hmm. like research.
Research, because we can already do it or because right. we already did do it.
Right.
And so right. sometimes I'm kind of wondering, like, how much of speculation actually happens in speculative fiction? I have noticed too, and I do plan on teaching, I think my next course that I'll design is probably going to be something on pandemic fiction. I think we're out of it enough that maybe it won't be too traumatizing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, like, it seems to me that every couple of years we go through like a new heavy, like a big genre. So for a little bit, we were all about, you know, vampires, and then we were all about zombies. And now it seems to me like we're all about plague fiction. And it's like, yeah, no kidding. Like, we need to try and process the thing that just happened to us. So I think in some ways, speculative fiction is actually retrospective fiction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I research the project I ended up thinking was what I wanted to have worked on, if that verb tense works, is like Cold War nuclear narratives. One of the things I find interesting about that, the 50s in particular and 60s to some extent, is how informative it is. And sometimes, even just in a really, really quotidian sense, weirdly comforting.
Yeah.
Not in the sense of like, oh, we don't have to worry about anything. But like, as you were saying, we've been through things before. Not the same things, but people have grappled with the end of the world since the beginning of the world. And so I find that period in particular interesting because people were in a way that must have really made living daily life challenging.
Mm-hmm.
If you were thinking about nuclear war, like the temporality of that threat of at any given moment, everything
yeah.
would be gone, like right now.
Yeah.
And so a lot of scholars of that, of contemporary scholars of that period talk about the waiting, the suspense that kind of informs a lot of literature and cultural production of that period. Another scholar, Dan Grousen, talks about how, you know, a lot of narratives from the sort of postmodern period, which he's relating back to the Cold War, just don't end in really conventional ways. They have weird endings because no one knew how to grapple with the cultural ending that was hanging over them. So I find that idea fascinating of like always looking for analogs or connections when you kind of can sometimes think of your own situation as singular, maybe.
Margaret Atwood likes to write a lot about binaries. She's really well known for those of us who really, really read her stuff. She has a distinct pattern of establishing a binary and then destroying it by the end of the book. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I mentioned was like, oh, this idea that speculative fiction is actually retrospective fiction. And you mentioned this thing of like the importance of immediacy and the focus on immediacy mm-hmm. ends up leading to an obsession on delay and on mm-hmm. suspense. On waiting. So it's like these two things that are supposedly contrasting and mutually exclusive are in fact just the same thing. Just in terms of talking about apocalypse, you know, we either have climate change apocalypse or the nuclear apocalypse. Something that I wanted to consider in with regards to my speculative fiction course that's kind of germinating in my brain is Lawrence Gross, an Anishinaabe philosopher, writer, thinker, has put forward this idea of instead of saying that Indigenous people suffer from PTSD or intergenerational trauma, he has put forward that Indigenous people suffer from post-apocalypse stress disorder, so PASD, because for many Indigenous people, the loss of their culture, the loss of, or the, you know, ongoing loss of Indigenous languages is akin to an apocalypse. It is the loss of a world. Yeah, and that is what they are suffering from. And so I thought it would be quite interesting to look at, I mean, and obviously there were resurgences all over the place. And that's part of what my talk is going to touch on. But I did want to think about this combination of speculative fiction, which requires that we imagine a future with at the same time, this idea of post-apocalyptic stress disorder, which we could argue members of our society are actively going through. Meanwhile, other members of our society are afraid of it.
Yes. And that loops back around to nuclear issues, because one of the interesting conversations more recently around nuclear texts and narratives has been, you know, the traditional insistence in a lot of mostly white scholars' discourse has been, a lot of, you know, this kind of writing about anticipating the end.
Yes.
Or anticipating nuclear war. And there's been more recent scholarship on how materially that happened to often Indigenous peoples. Not nuclear war per se, but for instance, nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands, which affected Indigenous Marshall Islanders who lived through their part of their land being destroyed or made uninhabitable by nuclear detonations. So it's an interesting and timely reminder, and the Navajo too, as well as downwinders of other cultural backgrounds in the United States, of like it actually happened to some people. You know, there's this kind of myth that sort of nuclear weapons weren't used, except for in Japan, right? Mm-hmm. And, oh, the 2,000 were detonated, most of which are also, you know, intersect with colonial spaces.
Siberia.
Yeah.
Outback in Australia.
Exactly. Yeah. Bryn, thank you very much. This was fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Theo. Thanks for the invitation. It was a good time.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Bryn Skybo for joining me in conversation. Technical production by Robin Davies. Music by Greg Bush. The colloquium series will be back in February with a presentation by Dr. Yoichi Mukai from Linguistics titled All Things Language, Linguistics of VIU. For more information, go to ah.viu.ca and click on Colloquium Series. My name's Theo Finnegan. Thanks for listening.